Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded October 23rd, 2024. Well, the old saw says no news is good news, but in the free world today, where media is divided across platforms and nuanced by hues along the credibility continuum, it may be fairer to say some news is no good at all. But where it comes to the disaster of Gaza and its near neighbors, there's little comedy and subtlety of meaning and wry wordplay. Now, no real news means genocide. Dr. Alan McLeod is senior staff writer for Mint Press News and author of the books Bad News from Venezuela, 20 Years of Fake News and Misreporting, and Propaganda in the Information Age, Still Manufacturing Consent. McLeod has also contributed to the online publications Fair.org, The Gray Zone, and Common Dreams, among others. His recent piece at Mint Press revealed the Israeli spies writing American news reveals to readers the moles and spooks behind news and social media platforms their publishers knew were there all along. Alan McLeod in the first half. And Barrick Gold is a titan in the global mining business, a Canadian giant of a sort, that doesn't brook interference in either its digging in the dirt or dirt being dug up about its political field salting. The litigious Barrick went after American reporting investigator Greg Palast and The Guardian as he reported in the year 2001 for, quote, quoting an Amnesty International report which alleged that 50 miners might have been buried alive in Tanzania by a company now owned by Barrick, end quote. Almost a quarter of a century later, Mining Watch Canada reports hearings commenced in the Ontario Superior Court of Justice in Toronto, quote, on behalf of 32 plaintiffs from Tanzania against Barrick Gold Corporation. The indigenous Kuria people are Barrick's neighbors who claim the North Mara Gold Mines police force have committed acts of extreme violence against them, acts that include beatings, torture, and shootings that have resulted in the deaths of some of the villagers. Catherine Cummins is a research coordinator with Mining Watch Canada and contributes in bringing its report, Barrick in Toronto Court over allegations of acts of extreme violence at North Mara Mine in Tanzania, into the open. Catherine Cummins and the Kuria people feeling the weight of Barrick's heavy hand in the second half. But first, Alan McLeod and Israel's spies providing your views of the modern Holocaust. Well, welcome back to the program, Alan.
It's great to be with you. How are you?
Well, I'm terrific, and it's been too long. Judging by my records, we haven't spoken since 2021. It was a whole different world back then. But, Alan, before getting to the spooks in our news feeds that you've written about, the last time we did speak, it was in the early days of the Biden presidency, and you talked about the intriguing La Villa del Umar. Considering the worsening conditions on Cuba, could you remind our listeners of the Biden policy towards the island at the time of his ascension, as we witness now his political sunset?
The start of his presidency, in fact, before he came in, Biden was promising that he would actually end the embargo and the blockade that the Trump administration had really worsened. That has not been the case. And in fact, the Biden administration has ramped up sanctions against Cuba. And it's one of the driving factors of the island's difficult economic position that it finds itself in. When we last spoke, we were talking about a U.S.-backed attempt to overthrow the Cuban government set up by Miami Cubans and pushed through social networks such as Facebook. That one failed, but the Biden administration used that as an excuse to put on even more, levy even more sanctions against the island on the grounds that the Cuban government was oppressing its people. In the past couple of years, we've seen crop yields go down. We've seen serious difficulties with electricity production, and there's been a brain drain as well. A lot of people have left Cuba because of this difficult economic circumstance that it finds itself in. But as I said, a lot of this is down to U.S. policy, and it is the specific stated goal of U.S. policy to bring about hunger, desperation, and suffering on the island so that they do turn against their government. However, from what I've seen from internal polling, it doesn't really appear as such that the Cuban people are ready to rise up and overthrow their government. They do see that a lot of their problems are in fact inflicted from the nation to their north.
Oh, well, definitely. I was there in 2013 during the Obama presidency when things had lessened up. The pressure from the United States had lessened up somewhat on the island. There was businesses starting. There was food being delivered to restaurants from Miami by jet every day at the airport. And high-end European-style restaurants. Cubans were coming back from Europe to open these places, and things were looking up. And there was the beginning of what looked to be a middle-class economy. I can't imagine what it's like now.
Well, to a certain extent, that middle-class economy was actually specifically a goal of the U.S. government to try and foster this kind of reactionary middle class that might provide a counter-revolutionary bulwark against the government. I'm not sure if that's actually worked or not, but that was their plan anyway.
Well, I guess they've given it up. Well, now, not to get off track too much, there's a parallel, and it's been remarked upon often enough, between the, as you term them, the Miami Cubans and the Israeli lobby in the United States, where you have this small population offshore steering the ship of state, as it were, or at least being accused of doing that by in some quarters. Now, to Israel, your article revealed the Israeli spies writing America's news. We don't hear there's a big wave of foreign interference going on in Canada too these days. We don't hear much about the foreign interference in the press, oddly enough, in the press, but you're writing about it here. What's the story?
Exactly. I mean, we talk about foreign interference all the time, but when it comes to Israel, that they've given a free pass because they're treated as a 51st state. This investigation you're talking about is called Revealed, the Israeli Spies Writing America's News, and it's on mintpressnews.com. And I found a network of former Israeli spies who are actually working in some of the most prestigious news outlets in the United States and producing news about Israel-Palestine for an American audience. Perhaps the best example of this is Barak Ravid, who actually won the prestigious White House Press Correspondents Prize for Journalism this year. And Ravid has basically made a career at Axios, printing stuff, anonymous stuff that the Israeli government or the American government has told him, and presenting it as a scoop, when in fact what he's doing is just laundering government talking points into the media. But more blatant than that, we have to remember, Barak Ravid is an Israeli spy, or at least he was until quite recently. He was an agent of Unit 8200, the very controversial Israeli spying group. And until 2023, so last year, he was actually a reservist in that Israeli military group. Now, Unit 8200 has been in the news recently because it is widely understood that that was the group that was behind the Lebanese pager attack that injured thousands of civilians. Unit 8200 is all about cyber warfare, espionage, spying, and carrying out special operations. And it's perhaps the most notorious group within the Israeli military. It was also behind generating an AI kill list of tens of thousands of civilians in Gaza that the Israeli military then used to attack the densely populated strip. But Barak Ravid is far from the only person in Washington working in top news agencies that has this record of working with the Israeli military. Shachar Peled, for example, spent 3 years as an officer in Unit 8200. So she was actually a leader of the team analyzing surveillance, intelligence, and cyber warfare. And she also served as a technology analyst for Shin Bet, another Israeli intelligence firm. And yet, despite that, in 2017, CNN decided to hire her as a producer and writer for some of their most important TV shows, like the ones that are presented by Fareed Zakaria and Christian Amanpour. Another Unit 8200 agent who went on to work for CNN was Tal Heinrich. She spent 3 years as a Unit 8200 agent. And then in 2014, she was given a job as a desk producer for CNN. And she was actually producing content about Israel-Palestine specifically. And that was at the time of Operation Protective Edge, which was Israel's previous bombardment of Gaza. So a former Israeli intelligence operative was actually producing news for an American audience about Israel's crimes in Gaza. And that sort of enormous conflict of interest was not even remarked upon. Now, there are loads of other examples I could go into from the article, from CNN, from the New York Times, from other big outlets like CNBC. What does this mean? This really shows, I think, that these positions in the media are very, very highly sought after. And yet the fact that big media outlets are giving these jobs to people with this kind of background and experience shows how little they see this as a problem. For me, I think everybody would see this as a gigantic problem if these people were former Hezbollah or Hamas officials or producing intelligence for the governments of Iran or Russia or whatever. But when it's Israel, it's just treated like they are a 51st state, like they were ex-US military, for example. And that is a huge problem because of Unit 8200's past and indeed its present actions in Gaza.
Well, when you write about Israeli spies writing America's news, American spies write American news as well. And it's not really new that there would be spooks and spies involved in journalism. The two professions overlap nicely, from Graham Greene to the Washington Post, for example. What's so different about what you're writing about here?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I don't think we should be accepting that every time we turn on cable news, there's some person who used to be a senior national security state official opining like he is a serious analyst or an objective journalist when it comes to national security matters. They aren't. But I guess what makes it particularly blatant is Israel is a foreign country, and it is a foreign country that is engaging in an act of aggressive warfare against multiple other countries in its vicinity. So the fact that these people can be entrusted with producing content for an American audience about wars that America shouldn't really have very much to do with, but unfortunately does. This is absolutely blatant, and people should know about it. They should at least be understanding that a lot of these big corporate media outlets are employing people with extremely questionable pasts to produce news which is supposed to be objective. And of course it isn't. And that's one of the many reasons why American corporate media is so bad when it comes to Israel-Palestine.
Barak Ravid accepted his White House Press Correspondents Award for, quote, overall excellence. And he was described by some of his colleagues as having a deep, almost intimate levels of sourcing in the U.S. and abroad. Well, yeah, intimate, I can only imagine. This in front of all of his peers, all of the top flight journalists in the United States, I'm sure that almost all of them know who he is and more importantly, what he is. And yet this silence, this conspiracy of silence continues. What do you make of the reaction of so-called journalists in the United States at the top level to what you're revealing here? Why haven't they revealed it?
I think it goes to show just how bought and paid for and how ideological our corporate media is when it comes to any issue, really, but specifically about Israel-Palestine as well. The reality is that when you look at Ravid's output, it really isn't very different from what you would see from any New York Times or CNN or Fox News journalist putting out the same stuff. And that is a real damning testimony. That's a damning indictment of our current media system, that people look at his content and it's really indistinguishable from any other source, which basically means that what we're being fed is US and Israeli propaganda when it comes to Israel-Palestine. That shouldn't be surprising, because people who have really been following this issue know that this sort of censorship comes from the top down. For example, there was a leaked New York Times memo that came out recently that said that senior management were instructing New York Times journalists that they couldn't use certain words in their Israel-Palestine coverage, mm-hmm. including genocide, ethnic cleansing, even words like refugee camp or even Palestine were to be avoided. Now, if you're being told that from senior management, you know what that means. That means you have to cover it in a certain way. And if you're not able to actually use those kind of words, you cannot give an accurate perception of what is going on. And so ultimately, yeah, I think it is a really damning indictment on our media that people like Ravid can Can be accepted into this milieu with barely anyone batting an eyelid. Now, there were activists outside this White House press correspondents' dinner who were calling for journalists in there not to show up in solidarity with the more than 100 journalists who have been killed while covering Israel's war on Gaza and on Lebanon and Syria as well. But they ignored those pleas and, in fact, clacked and cheered when Joe Biden embraced Ravid like a brother. And that really goes to show just how close the relationship between the US and Israel is, and also how the press has given up its role, its self-appointed role as a check on power, as the fourth estate. It doesn't function like that. It functions to back up official positions, and it basically functions as a mouthpiece of Washington now. And that is why we need a free, open, and an alternative media as well.
Well, and that was in April. That was half a genocide ago, at least half of the latest iteration of Israel's genocide against Gaza ago. And there was pictures of embarrassed, awkward journalists going in, crossing the picket line of their lesser colleagues to attend that event that really gave the air of a let them eat cake or let them read shit sort of vibe.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, listen, in order to become an uppercase J journalist nowadays in North America or in Western Europe or wherever, what I mean by that is working for somewhere like CNN or the New York Times or one of these big outlets, you really have to, first of all, get a degree from a prestigious American university. There was a study that showed that New York Times journalists are more likely to have graduated from the Ivy League than senators or billionaires. So that just goes to show from what sort of pool we are plucking journalists. They are from the elite. Now, not many people in the United States can afford to spend $70,000, $80,000 on tuition every year to go to some of these elite universities. And then they certainly can't afford to do, 6 months or 1 year's internship at these places where they're not getting paid and they just move to New York or Washington, D.C. to work for free. Those are the sorts of things you have to do to get your foot into the door of modern journalism. And what that means is journalism today in the United States is full of Nepo babies or people from elite families. What that means for us is that they have a very specific view and nature of the world, which doesn't jive with the rest of us. And so what you're saying about them crossing the picket lines, I'm really not surprised about, because ultimately journalism is now by and for the elite, not by and for the people. And that is a real problem. And it would be a problem even if our media outlets weren't already owned by billionaires. But the fact that they are is just compounding that problem.
Well, then, can we be glad that they're dying? I mean, or are they dying? Do you think that the legacy so-called media is lost so much credibility and so much attention that things like the New York Times and the Washington Post and the major networks in the United States and even CNN, their influence is all a Potemkin village of a sort?
Well, we're certainly living through the death pangs of the old media and the birth of a new one. This really started with the rise of the internet and specifically companies like Google and Facebook, who challenged the previous advertising-driven model of old media. Google and Facebook, because they capture so much data about their users, about all of us, were able to offer targeted advertising to companies all around the world in a much, as I said, a much more targeted way than newspapers or radio or TV ever could. And that really hit the bottom lines of a lot of these for-profit corporate media who simply could not survive in the new world where Facebook and Google were taking away their advertising revenue.
Not to mention The Guardian, who have their hat in their hand every time they publish, even though they've got a multi-billion pound fund behind them.
Well, that's very true. A lot of people don't realize just how well off The Guardian is. In some ways, it's a good thing that these companies have been challenged. But in other ways, it's really problematic because it tends to have been the smaller news outlets that have failed rather than the big ones like the New York Times and CNN. And we've seen a real consolidation of media into these gigantic companies. A lot of the time, that means that Americans are effectively living in what sociologists call news deserts, which means they have no high-quality local media serving them. A lot of medium and even large cities in the US now don't even have a single daily, and that's a real problem. And even if they do, those media outlets are cutting back to the bare bone. And some of the first things they cut is investigative journalism, foreign reporting, the stuff that actually costs a lot of money to do, where you have to invest a lot of time and resources and man hours into it. And instead, we're getting fluff pieces, increased celebrity nonsense, etc. So our news is really becoming dumbed down, and it's not informing us, and it's not certainly not providing us with the information that we need to become informed citizens who are participating in society. So while in some ways I say good riddance to some of these failing media companies, actually, the problem is that some of these, the bigger ones, are increasing their power. And not only that, when we look online, when we look at the news outlets that people do look for on their phones, on social media, etc., most of them are actually just the online arms of old media companies. It's FoxNews.com or NewYorkTimes.com that they're going to for their media. It's not like they're going to high-quality alternative media. Unfortunately, the system has been set up so that algorithmically we are driven back to exactly the sort of old media that we originally went on the internet to get away from. But unfortunately, it's being rammed down our throats no matter what device we use to access media. And that, again, is another enormous problem. So quite frankly, I think right now our news situation, our scene is we're in a perilous situation when it comes to media and news.
Well, and people in small towns can know how perilous that is when there's a disaster and there's no local media to help them get through it. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dr. Alan McLeod. He's a senior staff writer for Mint Press News and author of the books Bad News from Venezuela, 20 Years of Fake News and Misreporting, and Propaganda in the Information Age, Still Manufacturing Consent. We're speaking today in and around his article up at Mint Press, revealed the Israeli spies writing America's news. There is a post that I saw just before coming on the air from the Israeli Defense Force on Twitter, exposed. Six Al Jazeera journalists have been exposed as Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists, and they go on from there. The IDF is leading the call, though. They weren't long in being echoed by some of their loyal acolytes on Twitter who chime in, like David Collier, saying, well, if this is proven that they were affiliated, then every single Al Jazeera journal there knew about it. So basically, in one stroke, a self-described award-winning journalist is condemning to death, whether that would have happened anyway, every single Al Jazeera journalist as being a terrorist.
Right. And I wonder if they would accept the argument from my article, which found that CNN, The New York Times, Axios, etc., are employing former Israeli military intelligence officers as journalists. I wonder if they would see it as the other way around, where, you know, The New York Times or CNN would be a legitimate target for attack by Hamas or Hezbollah. I don't think anybody would accept that. But the fact that the IDF is putting this out is very worrying, not least because they have a history of killing Al Jazeera journalists in cold blood. I'm thinking specifically about the American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was one of the most famous anchors on Al Jazeera, known the world over. And she was killed recently in Palestine. I think it was last year, when the IDF shot her in the head while she was wearing clothes that showed that she was a journalist. She was wearing a helmet. She was wearing a big blue bulletproof vest with press marked on the front. So there was no doubt about who they were killing there. Not only that, as I mentioned earlier, more than 100 journalists have been killed, mostly by Israeli forces, in their attack on Gaza and Lebanon and Syria. So when the IDF actually identifies journalists as Hamas supporters or members of Hamas, that is very dangerous because, as we have seen, that is a prelude to them being assassinated. We've seen that the Israeli government, for example, says that there is a Hamas bunker underneath a school or a hospital or whatever, and suddenly that hospital is targeted. This is a pretext for an attack, and we have to see it as such. This is an egregious threat to a free press. More journalists have been killed in Palestine by Israel than all other countries combined over the past year. So Israel is the number one threat to journalists worldwide. And yet we see in the United States and in Western Europe, there are precious few corporate media outlets willing to call this out. And they barely even cover the fact that their colleagues are being killed at an alarming rate. And I think that really shows the priorities of corporate media. Their priorities are not to expose truth or to get real information out to their readers or to their viewers. They're not even to protect their colleagues. Their number one goal is to promote empire and promote U.S. objectives. And the U.S. objective right now is to help Israel do whatever it wants in the Middle East and hang the consequences.
The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that there has been 128 journalists and media workers confirmed killed in Gaza since the 7th of October of last year. And it's clear that they are being targeted. I've got friends that go in and they say, well, I don't know if we should even wear the vests and the helmets that say press on them because they're just bullseyes at this point.
I thought the same thing. Sometimes you wonder if giving the Israeli military the coordinates to your newsroom or your school or your charity or whatever you're doing, your hospital, is actually painting a big bullseye on your chest. It's really not clear, specifically because the Israeli military has seemingly shown very little respect for international organizations or for humanitarian groups. In fact, in some points, they've even, publicly celebrated these things and then laughed off the killings and said they were, terrorist sympathizers or whatever. So, as you said, Chris, I mean, it's very difficult to know whether you should be flying under the radar there. But because groups like Unit 8200 have so much information about the whereabouts and just all the details of Palestinian people's lives, they tend to know actually where everybody is. And from time to time, they come out with statements saying things like, we know where every bullet went, we know where every missile is fired, nothing is a mistake, etc. So these are really threats to anybody who dares to try to report on the situation in an even-handed or truthful way. Fortunately for the Israeli government, it seems like they really don't have that problem with American media, who are in lockstep with what they're doing and are trying at every turn to try to whitewash and downplay their crimes. And my article in Mint Press just went to show you one contributing factor to that.
Well, and beyond the press, the article also talks a lot about the social media. And I'm looking at The Intercept's got a piece on Meta, Jordana Cutler, Meta's policy chief for Israel and Jewish diaspora. And throughout these social medias, they are populated by the 8,200 alumni all through there. Something that you mentioned, too, that is referred to as Israel's Harvard, where people send, this is when you're talking about the Harvard educated journalists in the United States, well, Israel's Harvard is this a Unit 8200.
You don't end up in Unit 8200 by mistake. There is mandatory conscription in Israel, but Unit 8200 is an elite group which parents actually spend a lot of money sending their kids to science classes and math classes to try to get them into that unit because it is seen as a gateway into Israel's high tech, their burgeoning tech industry. And then suddenly you can get, a six-figure job in Jerusalem or in Tel Aviv, and maybe you can jump off to working in Google later. And a previous study that I did found that there were at least 99 former Unit 8200 operatives working for Google at this time. And there were dozens more in Meta, in Facebook, even in TikTok, which is supposedly controlled by the Chinese government. So I think the problem of Israeli intelligence infiltrating all of these media outlets, including social media, really goes very, very far. And we should be at least aware of that. But right now, the public knowledge about this is virtually zero.
Well, again, the article is revealed. The Israeli spies writing American News, the author, Alan McLeod. Go to mintpressnews.com. And you can also see a long form interview that he's done with my hero, Loki, on his terrific program, The Watchdog. Thanks a lot, Alan, for coming on again. And maybe we could talk again and not wait 3 and some odd years before doing it.
Yeah, for sure. Great to be with you.
Now, I want everyone else to stick around because I am going to be joined after the break by Catherine Cummins, and we're going to talk about her work with Mining Watch Canada.